Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. During our summer cycle of activities, our program, as during the winter, keeps in line with the basic aim and purposes which unite the effort of the individual United Lodges of Theosophists and their associates and students around the world. And that is to disseminate and consider together the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy in order to gain a truer realization of the self and a profounder conviction that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. During the summer months, in keeping with this platform of activities, on Wednesday evenings, we have a study class in the Bhagavad Gita, that ancient Hindu text of Eastern psychology and philosophy. And yet, even though we say it's Eastern, more commentaries have been written on it around the world than any other religious scripture. And it is in itself a brief episode in the largest literary endeavor of humanity, that of the Mahabharata. So even though it is not what we might consider a straight line theosophical text, it is important for our consideration because theosophy basically is an expression of those universal fundamental principles that can be found throughout different times and places in all great philosophies and religions. But what's particularly interesting about this particular book is its universal appeal to us and the insight it gives us into the human condition and how we can live practically a higher life while engaged in our everyday duties. So we know you'll find this study very interesting. This coming Wednesday, the study will be the Yoga Doctrine, and our class begins at 7:45 and lasts till 9 p.m. On Sunday mornings, during the months of July and September, we will be engaged in a study of the proem section of the Secret Doctrine, and we'll have more on this in a few minutes. We did want to highlight to you that on Sunday mornings, throughout the month of August, there will be no meetings, as there will be some painting reconstruction work in the lodge during that time. The meetings on Sunday mornings begin at 11 and last to 12 noon. The lodge opens at 10:30. In the center of the building, you see a book table upon which is displayed straight line theosophical literature, which are available for your examination and purchase. Before and after our meetings and during library hours. The library hours during the summer, as during the rest of the year, are from 5:30 till 7:30 on Wednesday evenings. Now, as said, we are taking up for study this summer the Secret Doctrine, or particularly the proem of the Secret Doctrine. And the format will be that we'll have a student who will volunteer to summarize the particular sections assigned for study. There is a sign-up sheet in the entrance to the library where interested persons may list their names. The material given out will be duplicated and placed on the book table in the center of the building here the week before, so individuals who do not have a copy of the Secret Doctrine will have material to study. And you will also see next to it a second document, which is a page-by-page study guide or commentary to the material presented from the Secret Doctrine. The student will summarize primarily the material from the Secret Doctrine study, but anything available in the reference material is certainly open to questions and discussion during the meeting. The purpose of these summaries are to help us understand the metaphysical terms used in the Secret Doctrine in a language that might be more familiar to us in the 21st century, but also see its practical applications and reflections in our minds, in our everyday lives. And so this is not just a philosophical study, but as everything at the ULT, we try to take these ideas and put them into everyday application. So before we actually take up for consideration the material from the proem today, we do want to call your attention that at the table, if you, right outside the room, if you haven't picked it up, there is a summary. There is a reproduction of pages 1 through 3 from the proem, and included with that is in the study guide a document called An Introduction to the Secret Doctrine. And we will, just for those of you who may not have it handy or may have not read it yet, we will just highlight certain things to you. But there are actually 3 introductions to the Secret Doctrine. The first one, the preface, gives the intended purpose or what might be the need for such a book as this. And it is said there that the Secret Doctrine is specifically written for those who are searching for the truths that unite all beings and forms of life. So we are not going to find in here any particular homage paid to any particular religion or philosophy or science. We're going to basically be looking at those eternal truths that are present and synthesize them all, because that is the nature of truth. It is everywhere, expressed in many different ways, and truth and religion in its true sense are ultimately one and the same, religion being that which unites us all into one source. And then in the second introduction, called the Introductory, HPB explains the need, the intended purposes, and the right attitude of study of this book. And she starts out by making the point that if we want to understand the purpose of this book, there's 2 things we need to keep in mind. And that is that the Secret Doctrine, the volume itself, is only a partial expression of the accumulated wisdom of the ages. It has many different names. It's been called, we call it today Theosophy, but in the past it's gone under many different names in many different languages. Some other English terms that are used are the esoteric philosophy or the ancient wisdom religion. And it's only a partial expression of that, and that the spiritual truths referred to in their real nature could never be expressed in words. Words at best can but point the direction to us. So one purpose of the book is to provide those keys, those ideas that will initiate us into that higher knowledge, that soul wisdom. And by that we mean that it is possible for any human being, who is any thinker entertaining the right kinds of ideas to thoughts and thoughts, to waken up in their own mind the higher faculties of intuition and perception that will allow them to see these ideas for themselves. So it is a self-proving study. But it does require the exercises of faculties of mind and heart that we don't usually use in other areas of study or in our everyday lives. The second purpose of the book is to give out specific details are teachings of this ancient wisdom religion that had not been given out in print before, and that is another aspect of why it is called the secret doctrine, that these teachings had been available down through the ages, but in past times, one had to go through a series of initiations and trials in order to prove their worthiness, but that from time to time, aspects of these teachings are given out publicly by those that preserve them. So that's another aspect of the term secret doctrine. It's not just secret because it requires the awakening of certain faculties in our minds to understand it, but it is the actual disclosure of a record of humanity, of humanity, which is not generally known. And the third purpose of the book is actually to challenge the materialistic doctrines of science. Now, Theosophy has the greatest respect for true scientists and sincere scientists. But what was true when this secret doctrine was written and what is true today is many of these scientists, in terms of coming up with ideas that are relevant to their particular area of study, begin to generalize to the human condition and consciousness, and tend to ignore or repudiate anything that is outside their particular endeavor. So the book, its contents examines that material fairly, acknowledging where it's true, and also pointing out where it's different from the teachings of Theosophy, leaving it up to the student to consider both. And the reason it has to be challenged is that these materialistic doctrines, even though they may be true in a relatively small area, if widely applied in the wrong way, have a tendency to crush out and stifle the higher intuitive and mental faculties of the human being that are necessary for us to achieve unity, to achieve a greater understanding of ourselves and others. So they need to be challenged as obstructions to higher evolution and learning. So there is a right attitude to study besides this, and that is that we are going to be studying material and exercising our minds in certain ways that we've not done before. And this will actually make certain changes in our nature. Even scientists today realize that the brain, the substance of the brain, the very connections of its fibers, nerve fibers, are influenced by experience and study. Changes occur there, and it's the very effort to make this study in a certain way will create changes in our nature that will allow us to understand, to perceive, and apply these ideas better. But we need to be patient and calm and yet determined to do this. The third introduction is actually the subject of our meeting throughout the summer, and it is the proem. The proem is a very special kind of introduction, and we may not be familiar with the term because it's really a classical term, and in ancient times the proem set the tone of an epic narrative, invoking the muses, but also offering an introduction to a hymn. And we have a quote here from Aristotle, who explains what a proem was meant to do. The proem was meant to, quote, produce the same kind of effect as the dramatic prologue and the epic exordia. They provide a sample of the speech so that the hearers may know in advance what the speech is about. Other forms of the proem help to remove or create prejudice, to secure the hearer's goodwill and to engage the hearer's attention, or the opposite. In other words, a proem can be used to encourage one to pay more attention or to ignore other things. And so as we look at this proem in the secret doctrine to get the widest possible overview, there's a symmetry. Just like the classical buildings of ancient Rome, there's a symmetry there. that it's divided into three sections. The first section deals with symbolism, which will occupy the initial weeks of our study. The second section deals with an explanation of the fundamental propositions of the philosophy. And the third and final section gives us a outline of the various stages in the evolution of the universe. And as said, the proem is an introduction or an invocation to a muse. And in ancient times, the muses, Hesiod tells us, were the daughters of Zeus and Mnemosyne, who preside over and inspire the arts and sciences, especially poetry and philosophy. The mother of the muses, Mnemosyne, is the goddess of memory. So the proem has a specific purpose for us. It is meant to invoke the memory of the soul, our intuition. Theosophy teaches that all these ideas, these spiritual truths, are already impacted in our spiritual center. It just requires the right keys and study and application to awaken our conscious awareness of them. And that is, so our purpose of the proem is not just to engage in it intellectually, but to begin to awaken for ourselves those faculties and realizations, so will we be able to make them practical in everyday life. So we hope this introduction will help us see the overview. And each week, as it says, as we said, we'll pick up a few pages for study. Today, we are going to consider the proem, volume 1, pages 1-3. We'll have this part summarized, and then we'll open it for your questions and comments.
It begins before the writer's eye, an ancient manuscript. On the first page, an immaculate white disk within a dull background represents cosmos with a K in eternity, space and eternity in pralaya, before the reawakening of the still slumbering energy. In later systems, that's recognized as the emanation of the word. The face of the disk being white and the ground all around it black shows that its plane is the only knowledge, dim and hazy as it is, that is attainable by man. It is on this plane that manifestations begin, for in this soul slumbers during pralaya, the divine thought, the plan of every future cosmogony and theology. But divine thought, like that of universal mind, must not be regarded as showing forth an intellectual process. Only those who realize how far intuition soars above the process of thought can form the faintest conception of that absolute wisdom which transcends the ideas of time and space. The conception of a personal God as changeless and infinite are thus unpsychological and, worse, unphilosophical. On the following page, the same disk with a central point. It denotes the dawn of differentiation. It is the point in the mundane egg, the germ within which will become the universe, the all, the boundless periodical cosmos. This germ being latent and active, periodically and by turns. The one circle is divine unity, from which all proceeds, whither all returns. Its circumference, a forcibly limited symbol due to the limitation of the human mind, indicates the abstract, ever-incognizable presence, and its plane, the universal soul, although the two are one. It is the one life, eternal, invisible, yet omnipresent. Now, this is a direct quote. Without beginning or end, yet periodical in its regular manifestations, between which periods reigns the dark mystery of non-being, unconscious, yet absolute consciousness, unrealizable, yet the one self-existing reality. Truly, a chaos to the sense, cosmos to the reason. Its one absolute attribute, which is itself, eternal, ceaseless motion, is called in esoteric parlance the great breath, which is the perceptual motion of the universe, in the sense of limitless, ever-present space. That which is motionless cannot be divine. But then there is nothing, in fact and reality, absolutely motionless in the universal soul. End of quote. Plato shows he is an initiate, saying theos, gods, is derived from the verb to move. The ancient Greeks, almost 5 centuries BC, taught that space was filled eternally with atoms moved by a ceaseless motion, generating rotary motion. Others taught the same, only adding to the lateral motion of the atoms the idea of affinity, an occult teaching. Occultism sums up the one existence thus: deity is an arcane, living, or moving fire, and the eternal witness to this unseen presence are light, heat, moisture. This trinity, including and being the cause of every phenomenon in nature. Intracosmic motion is eternal and ceaseless. Cosmic motion, the visible, or that which is subject to perception, is finite and periodical. That's cosmic with a C. Cosmos with a K, the noumenon, has not to do with the causal relations of the phenomenal world.
In the associated comments from our reference, it starts that saying that although the proem is an invocation, a call for help from our higher self, in a sense, it requires more than a call for help in order to develop the intuition. Effort has to be made. And the analogy is made between the scales, practicing the scales on the piano, and how one can try for years. And after a while, it becomes intuitive or instinctual in the fingers. They can work at their own. And so there are two types of scales that we are going to use in our study of the proem intellectually. And by practicing these scales, the power of the intuition will develop in us. And we're going to define intuition here as the ability to see everything in nature reflected in ourselves. In other words, we will be able to see all these metaphysical ideas applied to the cosmos as being reflected in ourselves. We'll be able to study it in ourselves as well, and in every department of nature. And the scales moving the other way, which represent intuition, is the ability to see what goes on in our life being reflected everywhere else in nature. So it is both a moving from universals to particulars, which is what Plato did, and a inductive moving from particulars to universals, which is what Aristotle. So we're going to go up and down these scales throughout our classes. We're going to look at the metaphysical, the universal, and continuously see the individual and personal application and the other way around. Yes?
Before we start on the scales, could we talk about the egg, the mundane egg? Because it seems like it's not really defined. And even the term mundane, it seems to be something that is ordinary or taken for granted or ho-hum every day. And we think, if we're using any of our intuition, that the mundane egg is really anything but mundane. So it seems like a misnomer to this student, at least.
So remember that in this first section of the proem, we're being introduced to the symbolism of the secret doctrine. And the first symbol is that of the circle. And the circle represents to us all those abstract qualities that we can imagine or apply to to deity. Universal consciousness, universal life, universal mind, universal space, universal motion. All of that is reflected in that circle, or that image of the circle. It is a circle, though, whose circumference is nowhere. It cannot be defined. It's nowhere, and therefore its center is everywhere. So we have to be able to expand our minds that way. So what then do you think the symbolism of the egg represents? First of all, what does the egg look like?
Yes. Oval shaped.
It's oval shaped or spherical shaped. Some eggs are spherical and some are oval, but it reminds us of a circle. So an egg in the ancient times had something to do with an expression of the power of divinity or the divine. Now, looking at all eggs we know, what can we say about the original form of every living being? What does it originally come from?
Ultimately, an egg or egg-like
thing. So we might say in every living creature we see, it seems to come from its original form is an egg. So the universe itself, or the cosmos, is a living, breathing reality in motion, alive in consciousness. There is no absence in any point of space in the cosmos of consciousness, mind, motion. In that sense, everywhere there is life. So the egg, the symbolism of the egg here, refers to the original form or the first expression of the universe. But just as we can think of a chicken or a human being before they actually manifest in the form, the egg or the mundane egg, the mundane referring to the manifested part, is but an expression of that abstract ideal. So the universe in its abstract form always exists, but periodically it comes form. There's an expression of that ideal in some form. Just as a chair, as Plato taught, the idea of a chair exists in the noumena, or the thought, eternally. But there can be many different kinds of chairs that periodically exist. So what else do we know about eggs? What else do they represent to us besides the ideal form? Yes?
Continuity. There's no beginning and no end.
There's no beginning or ending in the egg. And in a sense, there's no beginning or ending to the manifestations of the universe. There are periods of activity and rest. They are ever evolving. So the egg within itself contains the potentiality of a whole series, an indefinite series of eggs. The acorn of the tree, of the oak, does not only contain the model for that individual oak, but the potential blueprint of all the series of generations of oaks that will follow from that tree, there being no beginning or ending to the ever-evolving universe. Did you have another?
Yeah,
we were going to use the term, it's almost like a self-replication according to cycles, which is recreating itself.
The idea of cycles. So the egg also represents the power of reproduction. Yes.
So would mundane be ever-present in manifestation and also ever-present in the ideal? So therefore, would mundane be one way of saying ubiquitous in a sense?
Well, the mundane here would, when we speak of something as being mundane, we speak of it as being worldly. So we're speaking of the universe as a potential, which in the language of the secret doctrine is referred to as the cosmos. The potential ideal, the plan, which always is. And yet there is a periodic worldly or physical manifestation or expression of it. And that is symbolized in the by the term the mundane egg. In the Bible, it's called the Word made flesh. The Word being that ideal expression. And the ideal expression of the idea of the hidden idea, and the flesh being the periodic physical manifestation of it. Yes.
If I were to use the word mundane, I would say it's typical, usual. It's not unusual in any sense of the word. It is what one would, in effect, expect.
Yes.
And the attributes of everything being involved within what one expects would follow that reproducible, that in fact the blueprint of everything is present in the egg.
Yes.
And so what we've learned through genetics, if you will, the egg as a blueprint for all that follows is present within it.
Excellent point. So the mundane egg contains the plan, the ideal, the form, and as was pointed out, it's mundane or expectable. If we know the plan and ideal, we know what will come forth. So this universe, with all its differentiations of forms or beings, is expected, in a way, if we understand the ideal within it. But even in genetics, we may have the blueprint, but we know accidents happen. Variations occur. So there is a never-ending evolution or possibility for the expression of the various forms the universe contain, but it's always occurring under law of cause and effect. So we can expect, in its sense, its outcome. Another excellent use of the term mundane. Yes?
This is where I often go into something with an expectation, and I limit myself with my perceptions. So, you know, mundane in the sense that, you know, it is perceivable, but anything that is perceivable by definition is limited, and it's not a representation of truth.
Okay. So the question comes up, the difference between having an expectation and a prejudice. A prejudice being something that closes one's mind to the possibility of other truths and possibilities, an expectation being a realization of what we expect to follow under law and logic and justice based on certain premises that are laid down. It doesn't mean that there might be exceptions, it's just that we come to it with a certain reasonable expectation. And if something different from that occurs, it forces us to examine our expectations or our premises. Yes?
When we use the word expectation, we're also already surrendered, meaning dispensing with any preformed ideas or prejudices. In doing that, we're abandoning the so-called mundane our material world. What's helped me to understand is to conceptualize that there are two worlds. One world is in front of the retina.
One world is?
In front of the retina.
Okay.
the other is behind the red, so-called imagination, which, by the way, is real. And for the mundane A, as it is seen, there is a blueprint for the A itself, but it exists in the area behind the retina, which is the numinal element along the world. And we get to that world by expectation, real expectation, meaning that we surrender all preformed ideas and then wait for intuition, which is the downloading of cosmic wisdom into our brain on the two mind.
Yes. So the contribution here is that there is a world of sense, of which we is beyond the retina, the world of physical form, and then there's the world, the interior world, which is a real world of imagination, ideas, and in order to gain an understanding of that real world, that inner world of idea and imagination, we have to give up, in order to develop an expectation and understanding of it, we have to give up certain prejudices based on our external perceptions. The same way is true of the universe. There is a universe of sense, and then there is an inner universe of idea, of imagination, which we're calling here the mundane egg that contains the blueprint, the expectation of what will be. And likewise, in order to understand it, we have to give up certain materialistic perceptions or prejudices to it. Now, when we say give up, or we say study, it means we are approaching it like scientists or philosophers. We're investigating it. Nobody's asked here to accept or reject on faith. It's all a matter of study, using all one's reasoning to check, test, and verify what's being presented in the light of one's own experience. Yes?
It seems that you have used the word universe in explaining everything in the pattern. The word universe seems to be fundamental that you use in explaining all the aspects of what we're doing.
Yes.
We notice that.
The question comes up with the term universe and the use of the word. If we were speaking in some other context or university or lecture and we used the word universe, what image would come to mind?
The planets and the sun.
The physical universe, whatever we can see or know using the senses. In the ancient times, or the traditions that have come down through us through the ages, not just ancient but modern, that which represents the visible universe and this inner mundane egg, this ideal universe, which always is, the term for that in its completeness, both inner and outer, eternal and temporary, is the term cosmos, with a K. So cosmos has a larger and more inclusive meaning than the periodic material grossest expression of what we call the universe, which in the philosophy is called cosmos with the small c, to make the distinction. And so we can, when we're reading in these book, and we see the reflection to the terms used, it's important to know what we mean. When we say, it's the same way as using the term in human being. When we use the term human being, we're not just talking about the physical body that can be seen, but everything that's within the nature of that human being, their inner desires, feelings, intuitions, aspirations, which also in its fullness, inner and outer, manifested and unmanifested, embodies that human nature. Yes.
Something that was said earlier was that the limited cannot be the true. But this, on page 2, it tells us this one existence, this deity is the arcane living or moving fire, and its expression being the light, heat, and moisture, the trinity of being the cause of every phenomenon in nature. So if the phenomenon is the vehicle or container for the expression of that one deity, although the form is limited, wouldn't we say that its potential is unlimited, and therefore, in that respect, is equal to, or the sustainer of, or the reflection of, that unlimited potential, that divine one?
Yes. And the quote there from the Secret Doctrine makes the distinction between this ever-present noumenal cause of the universe and the periodic phenomenal representation of it. So from the beginning, we want to get the idea in this philosophy that something can cease to exist in its physical expression and potentially or within continue to endure. That's true of a universe, that's true of a human being, that's true of a plan. Its outer expression is periodic, comes and goes, beginning and end, birth and death. But the essence, the mundane egg, the prototype, the ideal for it, ever is enduring. Yes.
Well, in the beginning, the chair was talking about the scale and moving up and down, and we were wondering, now that we have some of the basic terms defined, could we talk about how we practice these scales, moving up and down, and is the music of the spheres related to the noumena or the K? Cosmic K, or is that something entirely different? Is that something that working, if we work the scales, do we eventually hear the music of the spheres?
Okay. Well, the music of the spheres refers to the divine harmony between this little sphere we call the human being and the larger sphere of the planets and the solar system. And the universe, that there is a correspondence. We will get to some practical applications of this, and some of them are discussed in the commentaries here, but there was another question, yes.
If you use the word noumenal, would you spell that word?
Oh, it's right, noumenon. It's on the backside of the pages from the prehistoric record, noumenon. N-O-U-M-E-N-O-N. Plato spoke of the noumena, or the ideal, and the phenomena, which is the expression of it. So you have the famous parable of the cave, which is classically an expression, where you have individuals chained so that the sun is behind them and reflects shadows on the wall of the cave. And being that they are chained in to only be able to see in one direction, they think that the shadows or the phenomena reflected on the wall are the reality, where the reality is the sun or the light that's behind, the noumena. And the whole parable there is about one of them that breaks away from the chain, isn't able to see that, and tries to come back and teach the others about that. Yes?
In my own understanding, I reckon that, or I think of that in terms of geometry, where to understand what a point is, if you can see the point, it's distorted, it is not the concept point. It can be approximated. The smaller the point, the closer to the ideal. And I'm trying to understand, is that what is meant by the difference between what is conceptually understood in the mind versus what is experienced through the senses and the distortions that are required in order to actually experience the concept of a point.
So that's a very good example. You notice how we cannot study metaphysics without bringing mathematics and geometry and science into it. This was the ancient way of understanding that all these truths we're discussing, moral, philosophical, religious, could also be demonstrable with science and mathematics, that there was no contrast, there was no contradiction, rather. So, as was pointed out, in geometry, a point, as we understand it, is the phenomenon. It just to write it down on a piece of paper.
The point's the concept.
The point is the concept. When we write it down on the piece of paper, it's the phenomenon or the representation of the concept, which is abstract. As soon as you put it down on paper, you limit it, because it has, even the finest pencil point is going to have a thickness, it's going to have a width, it's going to have a diameter, it's going to be a representation of an idea. That idea, we might say, is the phenomenon. The noumena. The phenomenon is the point. So on this page, this first page, you have this white disc on a black background. On the second page, you have this white disc with a point on it. The point in that white circle is a symbol. It's a representation of an idea, of a concept, of the idea that we have periodically manifesting everywhere at once, the expression, the physical or the manifestation of that which eternally is. Now, it's interesting that in science, they come up with this idea of the Big Bang, the idea that from one point in space, everything spontaneously explodes in all directions. It's close to the ancient idea, but fundamentally different, because the point is everywhere. It's not limited in the ancient system. So we have everywhere occurring periodically an expression of that which is hidden. And the best example we can find in our own inner nature is the awakening of individual self-consciousness, identity, from where it wasn't before, a general consciousness. We go through this in some way as we develop as human beings. The child at some point develops a concept of I am, and we see a gradual change in the language to reflect that, where there's a change from me to and my to I want and I need. But also, as we wake up in the morning, before we begin our activities, there's a vague sense of awareness of consciousness. And then, all of a sudden, we remember who and what we are as individuals. And that's a spontaneous occurrence that occurs all at once in everywhere of our conscious being, an awakening to individual identity. And from that point, we begin our active, manifested lives as human beings. The same way in the cosmos, from the point of the development everywhere of this manifestation, from the ideal to the manifested, from the plan to the manifested, when that occurs, active manifestation of the universe begins everywhere, in everything, on all planes. Yes?
Well, it seems, and just thinking and listening, we remember the outcome of the old Commodore 64 computer. And the first thing you do when you go online, it says, CLS, clear the screen. It seems that what we're doing today is helping each other to clear the screen of our prejudices and reference to how to listen, learn,
So we want to clear the screen. We want to draw in our mind a definite understanding, the difference between that which it manifests and we can comprehend, and that which we know is intuitively, but we can never sense, never grasp. We know it's there. Just like we know we are self-conscious individual beings. Nobody can take that away from us. We know that. And yet we know through our experiences that there's a time when we are not aware of that. So if we do as the Kabbalists imagine, we take that circle and we imagine it in our minds of our experience, and we expand our mind and our consciousness outward in all directions and upward in all directions and within and without, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger till we can't imagine our awareness or consciousness going any further. At that point where we can't go any further, that's the limit of our circle, our white circle on the black plane. Everything within that circle we can conceive of, but we intuitively know that just because we can't conceive past it, there has to be more beyond. There has to be, there's a limit to our understanding and our comprehension of what manifested, and yet there eternally has to be more. That eternal, that unmanifested, that we can never fully grasp, is the source, the sustainer, the container of all things, its deity. All that manifests within it is this cosmos or this universe or this one life or this universal mind, whatever we want to call it. Yes?
What we've been looking at here this morning is something that periodically moves through my mind and I ponder it, but then I have to say I'm not prepared to continue the process. I have to let it go. And this may enter too much here for the atmosphere of the practical, but I surmise that even people who do this regularly, I count myself one of them, I read this, but there comes a time when I realize that I have to let it go, but that I should let it go.
What do you mean, let it go?
Well, come back to the other meaning of the word mundane, if you will. I mean, because then I find in the things that are tawdry and mundane something that is also miraculous too.
Exactly. So the purpose of the study is to begin to exercise our mind in certain ways to awaken certain faculties of perception. When we go to the mundane world or the expected world is not what we expected it to be. There's something deeper. There's something more there. And we know this to be a fact. We can, as our relationship with a human being grows through the years, what at one point was expected or mundane or fit the pattern, we begin to see new possibilities within them, new expansions, new growths. That is not just a development within them, it's a development within us that allows us to perceive it. So, yes, we need to go back to our duties, our everyday responsibilities in life, but we bring with it now an awakened perception that allows us to see more in that mundane or their physical that we ever expected before. We begin to see everything or the universe reflected in our little lives, and our little lives, as was said, expected, if reflected in the universe. And if we do this enough, it's like the scales at the piano. The musician isn't doing this all day long. I mean, at some point they take a break. But after years of that kind of practice, they can do it spontaneously whenever they want to or need to. Yes.
I get caught up here in that there's, you know, five senses that we have and we're supposed to use in order to interpret and perceive the mundane world. But then in a lot of different sources and teachings, they talk about how eventually you're supposed to abandon these senses for higher senses. And I don't know, there's something that I don't get and doesn't make sense to me about how, well, we're here in this mundane world, we're supposed to use these five senses, why should we try to escape from that and go to these higher senses, which I don't even really know what they are.
Well, if you mean by five senses, the five physical senses, of course we use them in our everyday lives. we could symbolize those sixth and seventh senses or the higher senses as intuition and understanding. Now we know that the information we receive from our physical senses is deceptive. That what we think about nature, if we just use what comes to us through the physical senses, might lead us to conclusions that are which are not even the fact in physical reality. So this paper is not really white. It appears white because of the nature of our retina and the combinations of cones and rods and the way our eyes are constructed. To an ant or some other being, this paper would appear to be a completely different construction based on the nature of that being, the nature of that organism. This table may seem solid, but physical scientists will tell us that within the reality, the physical reality of this table, there's more motion, vibration, movement than there is static quality. And as it said here, movement, vibration is a part of everything in life. Nothing is inorganic or dead in that respect. So we're not to abandon the five senses, but to use our other senses of reason, of our intuition, to help us unify, to use some common sense in putting together all this information that we get from the physical senses, to complement them with our higher senses. Now, we do not have to necessarily wait till these things evolve. We can, in a sense, force that development if we're willing to. And it is part of the purpose of the secret doctrine for those who want to do it, to, in their own individual lives, take control of their own evolution and begin to develop those higher senses and faculties. Yes?
In fact, coming in to study these ideas could be compared to break out from our preconceived prejudices, to judge everything based on our limited experience.
The idea is to break out. Well, in a sense, we need to break out of the box. We know, and sometimes in a puzzle or a riddle is sometimes constructed to unconsciously to ourselves put us into a box or an expectation of how we're supposed to think, and the problem seems unsolvable. But then somebody gives us a clue that helps us break out of that box of thought, and now it makes perfect sense. Magicians work the same way. They work to deceive the senses, so we expect certain things to take place. They understand how the senses work. And once you understand the keys to their tricks, which they will not divulge, because that is the essence of their art and their living, that we see that we break out of the box of our illusions and we understand what's going on. So in a sense, we are trying to break out of the box of our normal modes of thinking and conceiving things that we usually bring to this from our previous education. Was there? Yes.
When the part is talking about abstract motion, is that motion present during Pralaya as well?
What does the part mean by abstract motion? Here's the problem for us. When we think of motion, we think of a mover and an object to be moved. This is motion. Why? Because there is someone who's moving it, and there's something that can be moved. All right? That's the phenomenon of motion. That's periodic or finite motion. What the secret doctrine is pointing out is that motion exists in the abstract or ideal form even before there are thinkers and objects to move or to be moved. And the best way we can understand it is to look, we'll finish with this idea, is to look into our own minds and realize that we live in our minds. We have an inner world of ideas, of thoughts and feelings and expectations and desires, and we live there. We know we live there because we are conscious of them. And not only are we conscious of them, we know that we live there because they are constantly moving and changing. There is life, there is consciousness, there is awareness, there's movement within our inner nature, even without it being expressed on the outer plane. We don't even have to move a muscle, and we know that our inner life is full of vitality, of movement, of change. It's the same way. This abstract motion is that eternal vibratory movement, our living fire, the symbol of deity that is everywhere in the source of all that periodic manifested motion that will eventually come. Now, we are just beginning to plant seeds of ideas. Next week, we will be going into these ideas more. Remember, the first few weeks, we are just looking at the symbols which have been used down through the ages to awaken and express these ideas. Our meeting's adjourned.